for argument is Williams v. Aetna Life Insurance. Mr. Bryan.
May it please the court, counsel. This court's traveled down this road before, and specifically in the Hawkins case. And as I'd like to point out, in the Hawkins case, if the incentives of the treating physician and of the plan consultant are assumed to be equal and opposite, consideration of incentives drop out, and the superior information is likely to be possessed by the treating physician, especially when it is the case that the consultant does not bother to examine the patient.
Yeah, but Sorin's report is very thin.
Well, we don't just have his report. We also have treatment notes and longitudinal...
Not very thin also.
Well, in terms of the longitudinal history, we have over a six-month treatment.
He just checks some boxes and leaves others unchecked.
Well, he also wrote a narrative letter as well to Aetna indicating his opinion.
That little note?
Yes, a handwritten note that he did write to Aetna. And we also have consistent...
That narrative letter is a little grandiloquent.
Okay. Well, he wrote a letter to Aetna indicating his medical opinion. But more germane to the issue of his opinion, Your Honor...
Look, it's understandable why these benefits administrators are skeptical about chronic fatigue syndrome, right? I mean,
well, sure, Your Honor. I can understand why. Is because it's not as easy as looking at an MRI scan and saying, wow, there's cervical spondylolisthesis, so this person must be disabled. However, for over 10 years, the CDC, the Social Security Administration, and the American Medical Association have standards for diagnosing this, and they also have objective criteria for it, which have all been met in this case.
What's objective criteria?
Well, there's 11 criteria. This was outlined in the appeal.
One of them.
Excuse me?
One. I don't want to hear 11. So tell me one.
Okay. It's the tender cervical and axillary lymph nodes. So that needs to be an examination. That similar to the issue involved in chronic or in fibromyalgia, where there's the 11 point tender point test, which in Hawkins it was confirmed.
Yes.
You have a sudden onset of the disability. Mr. Williams is not an individual complaining about any of these conditions beforehand. That's one of the requirements. Impaired memory and concentration, muscle pain and weakness. And I'm not talking about just the form that the treating physician filled out. I'm talking about 9 months, 12 months of repeated testimony of the claimant of these problems going back to the initial ER visit and hospitalization when he had to leave work.
Well,
he's
counsel,
seen six treaters.
As I understand this case, though, the fight isn't really about the diagnosis. It's about whether the disorder renders him totally disabled because it impairs his functional capacity, and that's what the benefits denial turned on.
Well, the initial benefit denial turned on Dr. Burton's opinion, which Judge Guzman, as well as opposing counsel, admitted at this point that, well, we're not going to agree to that because Dr. Burton, the consulting reviewing doctor, non-examining, said chronic fatigue syndrome is not a disorder, not a diagnosable condition. So let's move on to what Judge Guzman and what Aetna is saying their linchpin of their denial on the second denial is. And that is the restrictions and limitations which were outlined by Dr. Sorensen and supported by the record as a whole were not, quote-unquote, tested. And why I find this argument totally irrational is...
Hey, relax.
When,
you're getting too excited.
Okay, I tend to do that. when they solicited Dr. Burton for his opinion, because they needed a doctor's opinion, perhaps to rebut what was in the record at this point, or to get a fresh opinion, a fresh set of eyes, they asked, Dr. Burton, what are the reasonable restrictions and limitations associated with his condition? Number one, this is not a diagnosis. And number two, I don't find any, zero, no restrictions and limitations. So then when the treating physician, so basically what we have at that point is Aetna's very comfortable with asking physicians for giving their estimates of what restrictions and limitations are associated with a diagnosis. And then when Dr. Soren, who is, number one, at Northwestern, number two, in the immunology department and a specialist in chronic fatigue syndrome, when he offers his opinion as to restrictions and limitations, Aetna comes back and says, well, let's take a look at this form. There's 20 sections to that form. The 19th section has A through K. There's two sections in there which he failed to fill out in terms of restrictions and limitations, which only adds to the credibility of the report, because those two sections ask for the minute testing of, can he sit for more than 5 minutes? What's his range of motion? And if you look at chronic fatigue syndrome and the associated symptomatology associated with it, limitation in range of motion is not something that's germane to the condition. Yes, maybe you can't move your arms fully for an extended period of time because you have weakness and you have fatigue, but there, it's not a cervical condition. So the fact that Dr. Soren did not fill out those sections, I would have to proffer that this was a very succinct and thought-out report. And I go back to 7-26-02 when he was initially hospitalized and went to the ER and left work, and I've gone through the record. Generalized malaise, generalized weakness. The extent of this individual's disability is in the treatment notes, or one of the letters that where he was referred to a specialist at Northwestern in the infectious disease department. He was looking forward to his liver biopsy. He was eager to get that performed because he wanted to know what was wrong with him. So an individual that is of the wanted to go back to work, wanted to find out what his diagnosis was. So the fact that Aetna, in their final denial letter, says, we're not going to accept Dr. Sorensen, the treating examining specialist's opinion as to restrictions and limitations, despite accepting our own doctor who doesn't have those credentials, restrictions and limitations, in the original denial, we're going to say that this needs to be tested. And by the way, game over. This is our final denial. There's nothing in that plan document that indicates that that level of proof is required. And by virtue of accepting their own physician's opinion as to restrictions and limitations would lead any reasonable person to believe that if another physician who is a specialist in that area, that that wouldn't be required of his doctor. And if it is, how about giving the claimant an opportunity to have him perform whatever test that they're seeking? And I'd also like to point out to the court is the suggestion that a functional capacity evaluation should have been formed. Look to the Fourth Circuit on that, step versus... I think I cited in my brief. I don't have it. It's the step decision in the Fourth Circuit, which indicates that criticizes the functional capacity evaluation for the various obvious reason that taking 4 hours of testing what somebody can do on a pegboard in lifting, you cannot extrapolate that 4 hours into what somebody can do in a 17-hour period. I would reserve any...
Okay, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Bryant. Ms. Thorpe?
Good morning, Your Honors. Lynn Thorpe on behalf of Aetna Insurance Company and the Cisco Group Benefit Plan. Counsel, in his argument, alluded to the fact that there is very little value to the residual functional capacity questionnaire. The decision to submit a residual functional capacity questionnaire here was entirely the complainant's. This is a document that Mr. Williams decided to submit in connection with his appeal. There are several questions in this questionnaire, many of them, such as the tender points and muscle fatigue that counsel was explaining before, relate to the diagnosis of this condition. And as the court correctly noted, the diagnosis is not the issue here. The issue here is whether and to what extent Mr. Williams' CFS restricted his abilities to perform his job. The questions at number 19 are detailed, but they are of critical importance here because these are the questions that help the plan determine whether or not Mr. Williams can perform his job functions. They ask about his ability to walk and to stand and to move his hands and his arms. The difficulty that Mr. Williams ran into here was that the information that his doctor provided was wholly inadequate. On several of these questions, he answered unknown. He provided no information at all with respect to various physical functional capacity. On many of them also, he listed that they were untested. The standard of review here is undisputed. It is arbitrary and capricious. In the letter denying the appeal, Mr. Williams was told that the plan was denying the appeal because Dr. Soren stated that it was, quote, unknown, close quote, how long Mr. Williams could sit and stand continuously in an 8-hour workday, but that he was only able to sit and stand in total for less than 2 hours. It's unclear how Dr. Soren reached that assumption without proper testing. Dr. Soren confirmed that Mr. Williams was, quote, untested, close quote, when asked how often he could use his arms, hands, fingers, but stated that he was, quote, occasionally, close quote, able to lift up to 10 pounds. How did Dr. Soren restrict Mr. Williams to lifting no more than 10 pounds without testing? The letter went on to tell him that there was no record that his physical functional capacity had been tested to accurately determine his limitations and restrictions, and that without such evidence, the decision could not be reversed. Mr. Williams was told from the onset of the nature of the information that the plan was looking for. He was told in connection with the initial denial letter that his request for benefits was denied because, quote, the physical examination data do not reveal evidence of significant loss of range of motion, sensation, coordination, etc., to justify continuation of workplace activities. There are no data to indicate that you have sufficient impairment to render you unable to work in your usual occupation as a truck driver. The letter went on to tell him how to appeal, when to appeal, and the nature of the documents that he might consider submitting with his appeal, including a detailed description of functional impairments and restrictions with physical evidence to support those limitations. I think it's another very important point, and it's addressed more in the briefs than was brought out so far in oral argument, is there is a difference between a plan requesting objective report of fatigue as opposed to an objective report of one's functional physical abilities, which would show how your fatigue limits what you are and are not able to do. And I think that the district court correctly seized on this when it granted summary judgment, when it said, the plan did not reject Mr. Williams' claim because his fatigue could not be measured. It did so because there was no evidence that his functional abilities, which can be measured, were limited by fatigue. There is nothing
what
in
the... What is the criterion in the plan for being disabled?
The definition of disability in the plan is, and this was for the initial application, Mr. Williams had to demonstrate that within the first 24 months he was, quote, not able to perform the material duties of his own occupation solely because of disease or injury, and his work earnings are 80% or less of his adjusted pre-disability earnings.
And so his occupation is a truck driver?
Correct.
And it doesn't sound as if you'd want him driving the truck in your vicinity, does it?
Well, there is no evidence in the record to show that he was unable to perform these functions. When he submitted his initial claim for benefits, there was nothing in the medical data, and the attending physician's statement that was submitted.
But even if Dr. Soren's statement is inadequate and incomplete and so on, wouldn't it be enough if that were given to his employer, wouldn't the employer said, I can't let you drive a truck? If you got into an accident, would I be hit with, willful and wanton?
The decision that the employer would make as to whether or not Mr. Williams had the ability to perform that specific job, I believe, is different from the decision.
Why? It's just if he can't perform it, you said for 24 months?
That's correct.
Well, if he couldn't perform it for 24 months because of his fatigue and the various symptoms that Dr. Soren did list, then he's disabled, right?
But there was no evidence that the plan had that he was unable to perform these various functions. There was nothing in front of the plan that said Mr. Williams can only sit for X number of minutes or he could only stand for X number of minutes. And without that kind of objective evidence as to what Mr. Williams could or could not do, he did not meet the definition of disability within the plan.
Well, he didn't go back to work after the episode that resulted in him landing in the hospital, though, right?
That's correct. That was Mr. Williams' decision, and it may be that Mr. Williams has some sort the plan is not contesting that Mr. Williams was diagnosed with CFS and that he has CFS. The question is, does he have it to such a degree that it prevents him from performing his job duties? And again, the record here does not demonstrate that his limitations were to a sufficient extent that it prevented him from performing his job duties.
What do you make of item 13? How often during a typical work day is your patient's experience of fatigue or other symptoms severe enough to interfere with attention and concentration needed to perform even simple work tasks?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, which document are you looking at?
Well, it's the one that has the 20 questions. The Sorens Chronic Fatigue Syndrome Residual Functional Capacity Questionnaire.
And it was number 13?
13.
On 13 is your patient a malingerer?
Excuse me?
Unless we're looking at different documents, Your Honor, 13 on this questionnaire is your patient a malingerer?
Well, I don't know what I'm looking at something that's in the record, right? And it's
can you repeat what it says, please, if I can't find it.
It's called Chronic Fatigue Syndrome Residual Functional Capacity Questionnaire to Dr. John P. Soren, record 282. Don't recognize it?
I have it now, Judge.
Okay. So in item 13, as I said, I just lost it. This is item 13. Just looking at it, and I don't see it.
Ms. Thornwell,
Judge. Oh, here it is. I'm sorry. Page 284, not 22. How often during typical work days your patient's experience of fatigue or other symptoms severe enough to interfere with attention concentration needed to perform even simple work tasks? And Soren checked constantly.
Plan under an arbitrary...
August 11th, 2003.
I see it, Judge. The plan determined that this questionnaire was of very little value in terms of deciding what Mr. Williams' functional capacities were because Dr. Soren failed to complete many of the
yes, but the things he failed to complete, they're things like lifting and sitting and stuff like that, standing, walking, twisting, climbing ladders. That isn't relevant to truck driving. But having experience of fatigue that interferes with your concentration needed to perform even simple work tasks constantly. I mean, if this form were given to his employer, it'd be dynamite. You couldn't employ a truck driver whose physician has said he can't even perform simple work tasks because he can't concentrate. Even if he can twist, dance, do somersaults, if he can't concentrate, you can't let him drive a truck.
The plan, under the arbitrary and capricious standard, considered the questionnaire as a whole and made the determination that it was not sufficiently reliable and was not a sufficient basis for...
Well, it sounds as if they overlooked item 13.
Well,
they were just preoccupied with his ability to stand and lift and climb stairs and so on.
Mr. Williams could have submitted something to the plan after the decision was made to bring to the plan's attention any errors that he thought that occurred. And in fact, 6 months later, when the Social Security Administration issued its ruling awarding Mr. Williams benefits, his attorney sent a note to that effect to the plan. So,
what was the plan's response?
Well, at that point, it was 6 months later, and this was in connection with the plan, with Mr. Williams' request for the record to file a lawsuit. He also did not submit any of the records that went along with the Social Security decision. He simply advised the plan in the cover letter that the decision had been made.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Thorpe. Mr. Bryant?
On this last point of Ms. Thorn, other than notifying them of the results of the Social Security action, was there any submission that would...
We did notify them of the Social Security decision. In terms of the Seventh Circuit's ruling, pretty much at that point, is the administrative record is closed. You have a right to sue in federal court at this point. So if they were, I'm happy to hear that Aetna would be willing to consider additional evidence after they've made their final denial, but that's a position that they haven't taken in any litigation in this circuit. But that brings up a great point, is the disparity between the determination by Aetna and that made by the Social Security Administration. I know full well that it's not obligatory on an insurance carrier to...
You never made anything in your briefs about his being a truck driver.
We do have the DOT, Dictionary of Occupational Titles, within our brief in terms of what his requirements are, and it is also included in the appeal letter that we sent. And what's interesting about that job description is that they always refer to him as a truck driver, and that's it. However, his occupation was also included offloading. He was like a grocery delivery man. So he would take all these heavy groceries, pull off the dolly and do it. He worked by himself. The most accurate description of that occupation is in the appeal letter, which was signed by my partner Mark Dabowski and myself, which describes those actual duties. Social Security determined he was totally disabled from any occupation, not just a heavy job where up to an occasional basis you have to lift up to 100 pounds. And with respect to not giving enough evidence of the functional limitations, we have things all the way back to 8702 where Dr. Andara indicates stress test exercise stopped after 15 minutes due to fatigue, muscle pain, tightness. We also have him on Vicodin at certain points, so he's taking these opiate-based drugs during this period of time.
Did he ever direct the benefits committee, whatever it was, did he ever direct them to the fact, to the particulars of his job in relation to the definition of disability?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That was in the appeal letter. And that is in the record.
But you don't make anything of it in your brief.
Well, we outline the Dictionary of Occupational Title. And you point out number 13, which is actually, I think it's misnumbered on the bottom of the functional capacity. But you don't. You can take any number of those numbers that were filled out by Dr. Sorn, including the last one, which indicates how many work days would you expect him to miss on a monthly basis because of this condition, and he says more than four. And when they say the evidence is thin, all you have to do is look to number 8 and number 9. What's the basis of your opinion? And tender cervical or axillary lymph nodes, muscle pain, multiple joint pain without joint swelling or tenderness,
okay.
Headaches.
Okay, Mr. Bryant, your time has expired. Thank you,
Your Honor.